Welcome back to the program. Even with respect to our most benign domestic political issues, it seems impossible today for individuals to see both sides of an issue. With respect to perhaps the world's most complex and contentious issue, the conflict between Israel and Palestine, the ability to see both sides is near impossible, and has been so for over 50 years. Our guest today, journalist and historian Kai Bird, has done that rare thing of not only seeing both sides, but of living both sides in the Middle East. Kai Bird came of age amidst the Arab-Israeli conflict. He thought he fully understood the catastrophe of the Palestinians until he married a Jewish woman whose parents were Holocaust survivors, and then he understood Shoah. In his new book, Crossing the Mandelbaum Gate, he tries to make sense of the intersection of the catastrophe of two cultures in a world and in a region that never seems to miss an opportunity to miss an opportunity. Kai Bird won a Pulitzer Prize for his biography of J. Robert Oppenheimer in his book American Prometheus. His many honors include fellowships from the Guggenheim Foundation, the MacArthur Foundation. He's a contributing editor to The Nation, and it is my pleasure to welcome Kai Bird here this morning to talk about his book, Crossing the Mandelbaum Gate, Coming of Age Between the Arabs and the Israelis, 1956 to 1978. Kai Bird, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's terrific to be on.
Pleasure to have you here. You began your education in the Middle East at about 4 years old. Tell us what brought you over there.
Well, my father was born and bred in Eugene, Oregon, but he became a foreign service officer, and his first posting abroad was to the U.S. consulate in East Jerusalem, which was then part of Jordan, the Hashemite kingdom. So our whole family moved over there in 1956, and we lived in the Arab sector of East Jerusalem in a neighborhood called Sheikh Jarrah. And yet for a while, I went to first grade in West Jerusalem in the Israeli sector of Jerusalem. And as such, I could only do this because my father was a diplomat. There was only one gate as such, a crossing point between East and West Jerusalem, and Arabs weren't allowed to go into Israel, and Israelis were not allowed to come into Jordan. But I was, you know, a privileged little boy. I could cross Mandelbaum Gate every day, and so as such, I saw both sides.
One of the unique things about that period, and even as you grew up and you go through the 60s and even into the early 70s, is that even with the conflict in that part of the world, there was a certain innocence about what was transpiring there. Talk about that.
Well, Jerusalem was a very small town in those years in the 50s and 60s. And, you know, my childhood playmate was a little boy whose mother was a German Jew who had immigrated from Germany in the 30s and come to Palestine. And then she fell in love with a Muslim Palestinian. And so my young friend was, you know, had a foot in both communities. Now, these kind of inter-religious marriages were rare but not uncommon. And Jerusalem and Palestine and Israel were still, you know, very multicultural and small, and it was sort of a kinder and gentler Middle East in many ways.
There was also a sense of it, and maybe because it was so multi-ethnic in Jerusalem and Beirut and other parts of the region at the time, a sense of it being a more of a cosmopolitan crossroads.
Right. Yeah, I know. When I was living in Cairo, for instance, we lived in a suburb called Mahdi. And Mahdi had been created at the turn of the century by two Jewish-Egyptian entrepreneurs. And up until, you know, the late 50s, nearly half of Mahdi's population consisted of Jews who considered themselves to be Egyptian, had been there for generations. But, you know, all of that began to disintegrate, and the Middle East became a less cosmopolitan, less multicultural place as we survived one war after another. And that's, you know, one of the tragedies that I write about, how it became the Arab world became a less secular place as the secular Arab nationalists were continually defeated in one war after another.
Talk about that secular nature of the Arab world and how you saw it deteriorate over time.
Well, when I was, you know, coming of age in Jerusalem and Cairo and Beirut in the 50s and 60s, the ambition of every young Arab boy was to become an engineer or a doctor or a lawyer, to go to university. And they had multiple identities, I point out. They didn't identify themselves solely as Muslims. And their hero was Gamal Abdel Nasser, this sort of the wildly popular leader of Egypt, who had been duly elected in 1956. And he was very much a modernist. He wanted to modernize the Arab world. And he was an Arab secular nationalist who argued that the Arabs of Egypt and Lebanon and Syria and Jordan all had a commonality in their great Arabic language and literature. And he was a secular man. He loved American culture. He read American magazines, and he loved American books by Mark Twain. And his closest enemies at home in the 50s and 60s were the Muslim Brotherhood, these sort of right-wing religious politicos, and he put them in prison. Well, all of this came tumbling down during the June 1967 war and its aftermath, when, you know, this Arab nationalist leader was humiliated and defeated in the June war, and that left a awning political vacuum, for which was eventually filled by disillusioned Muslims who turned to religion.
It was also one of those periods where there was an opportunity, another early on missed opportunity, in that you had Nasser willing to, even at that point, willing, after the first war, willing to make territorial compromise, and a U.S. policy at the time from Eisenhower that was pretty tough in wanting Israel to withdraw from the occupied territory.
That's right. Oddly enough, during the Eisenhower years and even Kennedy and Johnson years, Nasser was sort of viewed through this Cold War prism. He was viewed as being too neutralist and therefore dangerous and flirting with the Soviets. They saw him simply in terms of the Cold War. But Nasser, indeed, when he came to power in a coup that ousted the king, he immediately began secret peace negotiations with the Israelis. And he repeatedly, over the years, indicated that he was willing to settle this Palestine problem. Even after the 67 war, he was indicated he vocally, publicly supported what was called the Rogers Peace Plan, which is basically the idea that the Israelis should exchange land for peace and return the occupied territories of the Sinai and the West Bank. And in exchange, Nasser said that he would indeed recognize Israel. But all of this, you know, didn't happen. And the American policy was to actually undermine Nasser because they regarded him as too nationalistic, too bombastic, and too popular in the Arab world.
At what point did the American relationship with the Saudis and with the oil companies begin to play a more prominent role?
Oh, this goes back to Franklin Roosevelt in 1945 and his meeting with King Ibn Abdulaziz Al Saud, where a very subtle, special relationship was established with the Saudis. But I try in my book to personalize all this history. I spent 3 years as a child, as a teenager, in Saudi Arabia, where at the time we lived in the consulate compound in Dahran, and down the road was the American camp, 2 miles down the road. And Arabia in those years, in the early 60s, was a very primitive place. It was jumping from the 17th century right into the 20th. In one generation. And in the American camp down the road was a 1 square mile area surrounded by a fence and one gate. And when you went in, you thought you might be back in a Houston suburb with ranch-style houses and green lawns, and this was 6,000 Americans plumped down in the middle of Arabia. And I described them, the situation, the relationship between the Saudis and the Americans as one where the Americans were clearly the cowboys. They literally had, you know, come from Texas and Arkansas and Oklahoma. They were oil drillers and riggers, and they wore cowboy boots, and they made their own Siddiqui brew, as they called it, their own alcohol in their stills in their bathrooms. And there are only two or three Saudis living in the American camp. And so, oddly enough, the relationship was sort of between cowboys and Indians, the Indians being the Saudis and the Americans being the cowboys. But it was the Indians who were keeping the Americans on a reservation, segregated. And this led to a sort of schizophrenic relationship.
Mm-hmm. You also spent time in Cairo in the run-up to the Suez War in 67. Talk about that period.
Well, it was these were the years 65 to 67, and Nasser was trying desperately to feed his people, and he was highly dependent at that point on wheat shipments from the U.S., U.S. aid in the form of wheat. And the Johnson administration sort of played a cat-and-mouse game with him and sort of kept him on a short leash and held up the wheat shipments, and this annoyed Nasser. But this was, tragically, I think, when the war happened and he was humiliated, this, as I referred to earlier, this opened the door to young religious, political Muslims, like actually one of my neighbors in Cairo, in Mahdi.
Al-Zawahiri.
This was Zayman al-Zawahiri, who was exactly my age and came from a middle-class Egyptian family. He was, as an adolescent, he was religious, a believer in Islam, but he had the ambition, like his father, to become a medical doctor. He was very middle-class. He went to the same sporting club, the Mahdi Sporting Club, that I attended and watched Hollywood movies on a great outdoor screen. And yet after the 67 war, this young man became disillusioned, you know, with his prospects and disillusioned with Nasser and became a sort of Islamic revolutionary. And we know, you know, we know the result.
You talk about the Muslim Brotherhood, sort of Nasser's sworn enemies in Egypt. Talk about the relationship between the U.S. and the Muslim Brotherhood as you understood it during this period.
Well, people forget, but history, you know, often comes back to bite you. And in the 1950s and 60s, because Nasser was regarded as an unreliable Cold War partner, the U.S. government actually began funding his critics, including the Muslim Brotherhood. And so they had the leader of one leader of the Muslim Brotherhood actually had an audience with Dwight Eisenhower in the Oval Office. And I interviewed diplomats who were stationed in Cairo in the 60s who said, you know, if we could find someone to launch a coup d'etat against Nasser, we would have. The Muslim Brotherhood was considered then a sort of right-wing, anti-communist political movement, and it had the support of America. And, you know, ironically today, they are some of America's worst critics. And if there was an election today in Egypt, everyone admits that the Muslim Brotherhood would probably win because the military dictatorships over the years, Mubarak now has been in power 30 years, has repressed any sort of secular, liberal, democratic elements and put them in jail and refused to allow a free press. And so the political vacuum, again, has been filled by these religious believers who, out of frustration, turn to elements like the Muslim Brotherhood or worse.
It is just remarkable, Kai, in reading your book and Crossing the Mandelbaum Gate, to just see over and over again how history might have been different if things had turned slightly differently at so many points. I mean, the point that we're talking about, obviously. I mean, and there are so many others along the way where American policy, partly because of the Cold War at the time, led us in directions that, as you say, came back to bite us.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm, you know, I sort of paint myself, I confess at one point in the book that I'm one of these, I'm like Leonard Zelig, Woody Allen's funny figure who pops up here and there, all at the wrong or the right moments in history to witness wars and assassinations. And indeed, in September 1970, I found myself in Beirut, Lebanon. I had just arrived. I was going to study Arabic and Middle Eastern history for a year at the American University of Beirut. And a few days later, four airplanes are hijacked in the air over the Middle East, and 3 days later, another airplane is hijacked, a fifth, by guerrillas from the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. And I'm told that my girlfriend at the time was on that fifth plane. She was held hostage for 4 days in the deserts of northern Jordan, and eventually everyone was released. But this air piracy instigated a brutal civil war in Jordan, where King Hussein was again regarded as a reliable Cold War ally, and the U.S. CIA station chief, with the support of the Nixon administration, encouraged King Hussein to crack down on this state within a state, the PLO, that had risen in Jordan. And over the course of the next 2 or 3 weeks, something like 4,000 Palestinians were killed. King Hussein's soldiers lobbed artillery shells into the refugee camps and eventually expelled the PLO from Jordan, where they ended up in the refugee camps of Beirut and Lebanon, which, of course, in retrospect, and we now know today that the Israelis had a vigorous debate in the cabinet about whether King Hussein should actually go down, because then if the Palestinians were victorious in this civil war in Jordan, they would have their Palestinian state. But this was a road not taken, and I speculate as an historian whether, you know, we might have had a far better outcome than certainly anything we have today.
At what point did you begin to realize or to really crystallize your views about the region as you came of age in your own right?
For me, in my 20s, I sort of had another crossing of Mandelbaum Gate when I met and fell in love with my wife, Susan, who is not only Jewish but the only daughter of two Holocaust survivors. And she taught me sort of the importance of the Shoah, the Holocaust, and I realized that I couldn't understand the dynamics of the Middle East conflict without understanding, you know, the terrible burden that even this daughter of the Holocaust was carrying. This sense of victimhood, this sense of dread about whether or not survival was an option. And, you know, I think you have to understand that Israel is a society that carries this sense of victimhood. And ironically, they have an enemy now that has over two or three generations now become, had also a sense of victimhood. And the two peoples have no, you know, they have conflicting historical narratives, and they don't see the other's pain, which is one reason why this 60-odd-year conflict goes on and on.
Talk about that notion of not seeing the other's pain. In so many ways, the idea of debating who is a worse victim in many ways is just so blinding to this.
Yes, it's a real tragedy. I mean, the Palestinians say, oh, you know, the 1948 war was our Nakba, our disaster, and we have been forced from our homes and forced to live in tents, and we are the victims of Zionism, of the birth of this Israeli state. And the Israelis simply shrug their shoulders and say, well, the Shoah trumps anything called the Nakba. And the Palestinians don't understand, well, why should we have paid for the crimes of Nazi Germany? And the Israelis say, well, we need a Jewish home, because never again can the Jewish people have no place as a haven against anti-Semitism and the next pogrom. And Israel is ours. And it's just, you know, it's a cycle of psychological victimhood that seems unending.
The other thing that emerges, I don't know if you'll agree, but there seems to have been such a succession over the 60-year period, even longer arguably, of such bad leadership that couldn't crystallize the views of either side to see the pain and suffering of the other.
Yes, and the Palestinians have been poorly served, but also the Israelis have never seized the opportunity to have firm borders and to commit themselves to firm borders. I have to say, we Americans have a responsibility in this, because we've allowed this conflict to drag on. We haven't tried to seriously mediate. We still empower both Israel and the military dictatorship in Egypt with billions of dollars of our own aid, which is basically supporting a status quo that is untenable. You know, today in Israel, 25% of all first graders, Israeli citizens, come from families that are either ultra-Orthodox or ultra-nationalist Orthodox, and live largely in Jerusalem or in the settlements. And another 25% of Israeli first-grade citizens in first grade are Muslim Palestinians or Christian Palestinians. So obviously the demographics of the whole situation, even inside Israel proper, is taking us to a precipice. And Israel, the time for a sort of two-state solution is quickly running out if we don't move quickly.
And looking at America's position, it seems that we've always allowed, whether it was the Cold War, whether it was oil policy, our relationship with the Saudis, our relationship with King Hussein as it related to the Cold War, as you were talking about a few minutes ago, mm-hmm. we have always let other factors interfere with really getting to the core issue.
Absolutely. In Saudi Arabia in the early 60s, when I was living there, I, as an historian, one of the things I wanted to find out when I wrote this book was what was actually happening around me that I was unaware of as a child. You know, in the 60s, I had a great life as a boy. I went out riding horses every morning, and Arabia was sort of a boy's paradise in that sense. But I suddenly realize now, as an historian, that in this period, 62 to 64, there was a power struggle going on within the Saudi royal family, the House of Saud, and a group of sort of young Turk princes wanted to turn the kingdom into a constitutional monarchy and have elections. But Aramco, the American Arabian Oil Company, felt threatened by this development and feared that these young Turk princes were going to question the oil concession and demand that the terms be renegotiated. And so, again, the U.S. government and the CIA supported the king's opponent in the form of Crown Prince Faisal. And Faisal came to power, and he was a modernizer in terms of economics, but he was very conservative religiously and politically, and he opposed the notion of any democracy. Now, I think this was very short-sighted on the part of Washington. We should have supported the Democrats in the House of Saud, but we didn't.
And yet, with all of this, there is, in your book, in your story, an optimistic tone that you somehow come away with.
Well, I write about the people, and you know, there are moderate Arabs, there are intellectual Arabs, and there are intellectual Israelis who do see both sides, like me. I talk about how at the end of the book I go back to Jerusalem and look up one of my childhood neighbors, a man named Sari Nusseibeh. And Sari is now a British-trained philosopher and president of Al-Quds University. And he and Ami Ayalon, the retired head of Shin Bet, the Israeli intelligence organization, some years ago came up with what they is now known as the Nusseibeh-Ayalon Plan, or Citizens Initiative. And it's a one-page document with 7 points. And it's a roadmap to peace that any rational observer understands is what probably will happen and should happen. It's a obvious, simple plan. It's there'll be two states. The border will be the 1967 Green Line, but there'll be an exchange on a one-to-one basis of land to take into account changes in the facts on the ground. And Jerusalem will be the shared capital of both states. And the Palestinian refugees will be compensated through a fund contributed to by Israel and the international community. This seems like a, you know, eminently sensible compromise. And it could happen tomorrow if we had leadership. Most, you know, 250,000 Israelis have signed this initiative and a slightly fewer number of Palestinians. It's seen by common people on the street as a reasonable plan, but no one believes that it can happen. It, you know, so I'm called, when I talk about this, I'm called naive, and I plead guilty.
Kai Bird, his book is Crossing Mandelbaum Gate, Coming of Age Between the Arabs and the Israelis, 1956 to 1978. Kai, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It was a pleasure.